Welcome, this is She, and I want to thank you for joining us today. We have special guest Chi Master Wuda from Taiwan. He was gracious enough to spend some time with me during his last visit to Los Angeles. We discuss abundance, the beauty of what is unfolding within his tea school and center in Taiwan, and his continuous commitment to bringing the sutras and the wisdom of the tea back to our modern society. Without further ado, let's dive in with Wuda.
All right, so Wuda's in the house. I'm really excited to be sitting here in LA with you. Thank you for taking time.
It's wonderful to be here. I love LA. I love coming here. There's really strong community of really awake and conscious people here, and also a lot of dear, loving friends as well. So it's always joyous to come here.
Mm-hmm. We're excited always to have you here. Feels like the support we need every now and then.
Yeah.
So thank you for arriving. Today I wanted just to connect with you about the next with tea and with you and the importance of what you're building in Taiwan.
Yes.
With the center. Okay. And how our society, we've gone away from, one, having necessarily mastery, how we used to know it,
mm-hmm.
and also having a place where you can go learn and connect with a tradition in its most purest form. So if you could share with us how important it is to potentially connect with tea, but also with mastery.
Okay. Well, wow, I mean, you touched on a lot there, though. And there's a lot to unpack. As for mastery, we could start there. And then I'll talk to you about a living tradition and a genuine tradition mm-hmm. and what that means. I think there's a lot of confusion about both of those things. I think in the modern world, there's often a conception that mastery is about control, and that it means greater and greater control means greater and greater mastery. But it's actually the opposite. Mastery, for me, in the ultimate sense, is when you find that place in you that meets the awareness that is primordial, that has been here long before humans were here. It was the same light in the eyes of dinosaurs, or even earlier, the animals, and that divine consciousness, that consciousness that is the foundation of the universe. And when you find the place in you that meets that, and allow that to flow through what you do, that's mastery. It's a bit like, and the analogy that I always use is like a river. You can build a motor, and your boat then is powered by something outside the river, and that's control. And you make it to your destination, maybe even quicker. But we've learned that method also pollutes the river and like kills the river, and then the river dies, and then you don't, in the long run, make it to your destination quicker because now there's no more river.
Yeah.
And so real mastery is harnessing the current of the river then and flowing with it.
Mm.
So this is just an analogy. And mastery also is about focus, but focus and control aren't necessarily the same thing.
Right.
That's where the confusion begins. Focus and concentration, though, are definitely necessary, especially in a world with so much excess. It's very easy to spend a life moving from distraction to distraction. And I often see people who say, you know, my hobby is X, my hobby is X, and I have these things and tools to make it go quicker. And you got to wonder, why do you want to relax quicker? Like, why is your hobby something that you want to do quicker? It would seem contradictory, like your hobby should be something you want to slow down and enjoy more.
Yeah.
And so it is about taking the time, you know, even if tea's your hobby, people say, well, you guys go and hike up into the mountains and get water, and then you use charcoal to make the fire, and then you drink tea really slow and spend a long time doing it. I'd rather use an electric kettle and really quickly get water and really, you know. And the truth in that is that sometimes we don't have enough time, and that's true for us too, and we sometimes then use an electric kettle. But if you had the time and you love tea, then why wouldn't you love going up to the mountain to fetch the water for your tea and taking the time to build the charcoal and taking the time to sit and drink it properly, right? So the movement of the world is often towards quick and convenient, but quick and convenient then doesn't bring that mastery. And we had that all, you know, even the in English the word Meister then became Mister, and we say that for every male. And that, you know, it shouldn't be gender specific, but, you know, usually back at the time when that word was developed anyway, it was the men that worked. Right. And the women were masters of the house and of child rearing and stuff. Mm-hmm. But now they can be misters too, because
mm-hmm.
we've enlightened ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a world where women are free, and that's as it should have always been. We never should have traveled down that, gotten lost on that byroad where they weren't masters. So now women can be misters in the sense of Meister, master too. But that word was so common because everybody at that time was master of something, whether it was master shoemaker or carpenter or and loved what they did. So there, and it's still in Asia in some certain ways that seem really foreign to Westerners, like Chinese people don't tend to not have a separation between their job and their life.
Yeah.
So like the way Westerners kind of live here and work over there.
Right.
And then you have your work associates and then you have your friends.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that's beginning in more modern era. Chinese people will get hobbies and they kind of will get together with a shared love of hiking or motorcycling or whatever. But a lot of them still live above their shop.
Yeah.
And all of their friends are people in the same business.
Right.
So if they sell tea, then they tend to hang out with people who sell tea and or tea farmers. And so they don't really have that separation of professional and personal that we have. And it comes from that time when, you know, your work was who you are. And, you know, what you did was really important.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a time to, like, retire from it.
Mm-hmm.
There's like 90-year-old tea farmers in Taiwan
that
are still making tea. Their son's taken over, so they don't have the responsibility to make all the tea that feeds the family.
Right.
But they still make their own tea for drinking, and they still make tea because it is who they are. And there's almost a sense that without that, they don't have meaning.
Mm.
And those people live longer too, the ones that have that kind of meaning and value live, I think, not just longer, which is awesome, but also more happy and healthy. And so finding something, whatever that is, that allows you to follow a road towards mastery is about also mastering yourself. And that's where tea becomes a Tao. A path, a way, a spiritual way. It doesn't have to be. It can be a commodity, a hobby, it can be all kinds of things. But that's the point at which you can cross and it can become a spiritual way, is when you realize that in mastering this, I'm mastering myself. And there's an old Chinese story that the student asked the master, how do I paint the perfect scroll of calligraphy? And the master said, you perfect yourself and then paint naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the same for tea. You perfect yourself and then you brew tea naturally.
Mm.
And then when you get to that point, the way my master always puts it is, if you want to learn how to brew tea, you have to first learn how to be a person, because only people brew tea.
Mm.
It's kind of saying the same thing.
Yeah.
And there's, you reach a point where you realize, Matt, I have all the skills and the techniques and the stuff down. For me, I was kind of silly, and I was a student that kind of bumbled. It took me many years to figure it out, because my master made awesome tea. and he made better tea. And I thought, well, it's because he knows all the technical stuff. How hot of water, how many leaves, what kind of pot. And then I learned all that. But his tea was still better. And then I thought, well, he has better teaware. So I went out and bought really expensive teaware. And then one time we were out in Wuyi Mountain, and he was using two mason jars, pouring from one to the other, and the tea was still better than mine. And I thought, oh, my. And then I bumbled. It took me a while to figure this out. But it's good, because now my students don't have to. I can use this story to teach the essence of this. But then I thought, well, it's information. So I studied a lot of information, how tea is made, how it's processed, where it comes from. Still no dice. Then that's when it hit me, right? It's about working on myself too. And above my bed now I have an old Japanese poem from a tea master from like 500 years ago that translated is something like, from the moment I awake until my eyes close, in every breath, in every step, all that I do, I'm preparing tea. And that's where you get to the point where real mastery starts going internal, starts being about, wow, I really noticed the difference, even more than between this awesome teapot and this junky teapot. I noticed the difference between when I make tea with a confused mind and when I make tea with a still mind. Okay. And not just the difference of when I make tea for a still mind, how the tea is different because I've made it that way, but also how I and other people receive it and drink it. Yeah. So in both directions. So not just how I make tea, what kind of mind I have as I make the tea, but what kind of mind I have as I take it in. Yeah. And how deeply it goes in. And then you know why people have always said tea is tranquil. Because tea teaches you a life of tranquility. Because she rewards you for your tranquility. Mm-hmm. The more tranquil you are, the more deeply she comes into you. Even on the surface level, you could have someone who drank a certain kind of tea for a year. And then you sit them down in silence and they drink that tea and they start noticing flavors that they haven't noticed up until that point. Wow, I've drunk this tea every day for a year. I didn't notice that there was a hint of citrus in it. Mm-hmm. But when I was quiet and focused on it rather than multitasking, I picked that up. So you're being rewarded even on the level of sensual pleasure, as well as, of course, the deeper stuff. So for me, that's what makes tea mastery. And that's what mastery is about, going in, finding that place. Because ultimately, if you look at that story where the master said, perfect yourself and then paint naturally, or perfect yourself and brew tea naturally, I'll never be that perfect. But that place in me that meets the divine intelligence, that place where my soul meets the great spirit, that place where my Atman meets Brahman, that Paramatman, that center, that is perfect. And if I can live from there, I'll live skillfully and wholesome and healthy. And what I do will have that power in it. And that's why there's a lot of people resonating with what I'm doing, because they also have that spot. And when someone writes out of that spot, or paints out of that spot, or brews tea out of that spot, it tickles that spot in others. And that's what, that's what we want. The other thing you mentioned was about a living tradition. And a living tradition, there's some confusion about that too. Because we often have this idea of a living tradition being like a chain of purity. Like teacher, student, and nothing changing. And it has to be protected and protected. And over there, they don't have the real thing because they lost it. That is more dead than alive. Alive is flesh and bones. Alive is in the living flesh of living human beings, not those who have passed away, or the books that they've written, or the wisdom they've left for us. There's a lot of Native American medicine stories about this, and I've written one in the Global Tiat newsletter, and it's online. But they're basically usually about a shaman who's, and everything's happy in the tribe, and he's married to a woman in the tribe. And he represents tradition. He represents all the wisdom that's been handed down, the books, the scriptures, the ways of making tea, the teacher, the lineage. And he marries the people. Good. He should be married to the living people. Because if there's no living people going to that church, it's an abandoned old building that'll crack down and be forgotten, as some spiritual traditions have been. They're lost. So he's married to the people. And then what happens? What happens in any married couple? They have children. And usually in the stories, he gets freaked out and he gets really scared of the children. And he often will kill his wife and run away, leaving the children for dead. But they don't die. Nature always comes and saves them. Usually in the Native American stories, it's animals. Mm. Animals come and save, teach them, keep them alive. And then they want to reconcile with their father, so they go try and find him. And he's found a new tribe. And they go there and once again, is scared and tells all the people, beware, those children are crazy. They ate their mother or some other lie. Mm-hmm. And the people also are scared of them but want to get away but don't want to kill them. So usually in the story, again, they do something like abandon them or tie them down and move on. But again, animals come. Again, they're saved by nature. And eventually, in some of the stories, there's a drought or there's a something, and the animals teach the children how to live, and then the children teach the people how to live, and the people realize that they've been tricked by this shaman and go live with the children, and the children become the new shaman. And hopefully the process doesn't repeat again, though it could. So the meaning of the story, to unpack it for you, is that the shaman is the tradition, the old ways, the books, the sutras, the church, and he's married to the people. And that means he's married to Suzanne. He's married to a living human being whose heart is beating, to the flesh of the people. And what happens? Children come. And what are those children? Those children are new insights. Because when Suzanne reads the old sutras, there's an alchemy that has never happened before in the history of the universe. The tradition has been there, and it has met many people, but it's never met Suzanne. And there's going to be new insights that result from that alchemy. And sometimes the tradition is scared of those new insights. Really scared. So it kills the wife, which is a severe way of saying it cuts its connection to the people and becomes distant. In some of the stories, he first moves away from the village and puts his hut outside, right? So then, but the new insights, they want to reconcile with the tradition. They still want to be with the tradition, and they go and try and find him, and he tries to get other people to be afraid of them. Those guys are scary, right? But nature won't have it, because those new insights are truth. So of course nature will support the truth over the dogma. And eventually the people will realize, and the old dogmas will die, because truth will shine a light on them, right? Yeah. A really good story to highlight this is that the Pope summoned Galileo and threatened to have him killed, and said, change your book. And his answer was incredibly glorious. He said, fine, I'll change my book. But I can't change the sun.
Yes.
And so, and eventually what happened? The truth won out over the dogma. But you got to get to the core of it, because if the habit of making dogmas doesn't end, people will just make up, this story will repeat itself. That's why this story was passed on in Native traditions, so this wouldn't happen. So what I want to say is that we are a living tradition, which means we're an open tradition, which doesn't mean that there's some kind of pure way of tea that's passed on, and it has to stay the same. Mm. I want my student Colin to colonize tea. Mm. I want my student Skylar to Skylarize the tea. Mm. I want tea and this tradition and this lineage and all that has been gathered and all the wisdom that's been handed down to meet that person and create new insights. And if those new insights come out of the spirit, this is part of in the mastery. This is where you need to be careful, because otherwise useful things from before will be lost.
Right.
We don't want that either. So there has to be a balance. And the balance is that as long as the adaptation is coming out of the spirit of tea, then it's a good one. If it's coming out of either your ego or a desire to be more quick and convenient, then it's probably not a good one. It's probably a better idea for you to continue to use the traditional way.
Right.
But if it's coming out of the spirit of tea, then it's the children of the marriage of the tradition and you.
Right.
And then it's that new insight. And then you come back and share it with your teacher because he wants to learn it too. Right? So that's what it is. And so we're a very open tradition, and it's very, very alive. There is a lot of ancient wisdom housed in our center and housed in our tradition. We want to keep it alive. Not be caretakers, not be museum curators of a dead tradition.
Right.
So not be museum characters of an exhibit that you can come look at and say, this is how it was done. But a living tradition means that the tradition is in the blood and heart and brains and guts of the human beings that are living it.
Mm.
And the way they're living it is its current form.
Right.
And then when they die, the next generation comes, and the way they live it is the true form.
Mm.
There's power in that.
Definitely. So as you're speaking, I'm connecting just even the opportunities I've had to sit and learn from you and how I relate to it as I offer it to others, but how the tea tree is so, and the leaves are so adaptogenic within us. And if you can share a little bit about the center, how it will actually be adaptogenic to this epoch that we are in this moment, and the reason for the calling, I mean, it already exists, but the reason for the expansion to actually allow us to adapt to a new way of living or remembering.
The adaptation, I mean, we have a center and it's already been going strong for 5 years. The building of this new center is to achieve a little bit more permanency and to increase in size, because we're getting like 100 or 200 people coming and staying with us a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot. And you know, so we're a little cramped.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. It's what's been really beautiful is that Spirit has like guided the timing.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't felt terribly cramped. We know that that's coming, but it's like she's given us a little bit of room, because it seems magical that it's like four people come and like the day they leave, the next three come. And it would have been a little cramped with seven. We can house like 10 even,
mm-hmm.
but you start getting 7, 8, it starts being more cramped. But it's really worked out the timing of it, that we're getting a lot of people, but they seem to, like, you know, it's just organized really well. It happens on its own, and we've been blessed in that way. But we need that expansion. And the evolution is going to come in that we're building it in the mountains, which allows us to, farm all of our own food and vegetables, because a big part of what we're doing is we tea and feed people.
Mm.
So you come to our center and you get filled with tea and food, and it's that simple.
Mm.
And the wisdom stuff isn't necessary. So if that's something that's useful and helpful for you, then that's there. But really what we do on a ground level is tea and feed people.
Mm.
Free tea, free food. Mm. That's it.
You can expand on that the roots of all human species have a basic root need: food, water, and shelter.
Yes. And that's what we provide. We have free food, free water, free place to stay. And it's that simple. And it's about serving, too. So, you know, every ashram in India serves free food to poor people. And it's great that the poor people have food, but they're hungry again tomorrow. And it's great they get food again tomorrow. And in some ways, it enables them to be homeless. So you can see that there's something tricky about it. But the real function of it, the real healing, the real transformation on a nationwide level or on a global level of that practice is in the people that are going there and serving the food every day.
Mm.
Right? And doing it wholeheartedly. So that service, you know, and we're a tradition about that. One of our kind of mottos, catchphrases, is this is not a tradition where you learn how to make tea, but how to serve tea.
Mm.
And so I always tell people who come to the center, whether you help us serve or we serve you, you're of service. Because how do we practice and learn how to serve without people to serve? So there's people that actually kind of do come and stay at the center as like a vacation, because it's awesome. You go stay there and there's meditation and there's free tea and free food and a cool place to stay. And awesome. We're happy for that. We want guests.
Mm.
Because without, you know, the practice of tea is about making guest and host one. And that doesn't happen automatically. It takes years of practice and mastery. And in order for hosts, tea hosts, people who want to serve tea, to learn that art of making guest and host one, they need guests to practice on. So, I mean, it really is, down to its foundation, just that simple. We tea and feed people. And, you know, we do have meditation, and we do have wisdom about tea, and we do have teachings. But not everyone that comes is seeking that. So, and we also go out a few times a month and set up in markets and roadsides and just serve tea to passersby. And there's no teaching in those situations at all. It's very simple. It's about the passersby kick off their shoes and sit down on our mat and drink a bowl or two or three or sometimes 17 and then get up and go. And we hold space, and we hold a space of presence and loving kindness. And we, if they want to chat, we chat. If they want to talk spirituality, we talk spirituality. If they want to just chat about where you're from, and, you know, we do that too. If they want to sit in quiet, we do that too. But whatever happens, whatever arises, we try to hold a space of presence and calm and loving kindness and let them feel comfortable. And then they get up and go about their day. And all we've done is just given them that simple gift of some tea. And when we say giving them some simple gift as tea, we don't just mean the beverage. We also mean the time and the space. Like, British people understood that tea is also a time. Time / space, because they're one.
Right.
Scientifically, we know that even. Right? Mm-hmm. So, 4 o'clock, Britain, everything shuts down. There's time and space for to get together with the people you love and look at each other. And the tea is kind of, in the country like that, it's kind of background. It's more about being with people. And so, with the tea we've given them as a gift is the physical tea, the liquor, and its effects, but also that time and space.
So let's talk about space and giving and receiving. The tree lately, in general, has been teaching me a lot about how important it is to receive so we can give. So being that the center is set up to give to others and calls in people that need to receive, you fill them up so they can go and often create and do what they're going to do next. If you can share from your wisdom about that, of giving and receiving.
Well, the new center, I didn't get to finish that earlier, and it's awesome because this new question asked it again. The new center is going to allow us to farm our own vegetables and to have a tea farm. Because it's really important when you're talking about plant medicine, it's not just about the brewing of tea. These are trees, and they're conscious. And you have to come from the trees. There's a lot of plant healers now who don't do that, and it's kind of a shame because it's not really in the spirit of plant medicine to treat, to like take extracts from, you know, for like goji berries now with vitamin C. You can see shampoo now with spirulina. And it's kind of like not recognizing the consciousness of the plants. And whereas, you know, like Native American healers or any indigenous healers or even traditional Chinese medicinal healers would spend time with the plant and talking to it, whether verbally or non-verbally, sometimes both. I do both with tea. And asking it for permission often. And then they themselves cut it, they themselves dry it, they themselves... And by having a tea farm on the center, guests are not just going to be able to drink tea as they can now, because we don't have a tea farm now. Now, we do offer guests the experience to be on a tea farm and to make tea, but we got to drive a few hours and go to someone else's farm who's, you know, it's okay, it's our brother, but it'll be nice when it's on our land. And we're not going to grow tea, you know, commercially. It's just going to be, like, there for the guests to sit amongst the trees and talk to them and also pick your own tea and process it and take it home with you and that kind of thing. And as far as giving and receiving, the universe obviously is giving. We just got donated this land, and it's incredible. It has cliffs and waterfall and a river and beautiful views and hundreds of sakura trees that are in bloom. You can go on our YouTube channel and see a bunch of photos of them in bloom. And it's glorious land. And it's clean and clear and quiet. It'll be a great place to grow things. It's really vibrant. Monkeys, spiders, tons of greens. It'll grow really awesome vegetables and tea. Tea likes mist, and there's mist there every day, and the waterfall is awesome, and the water is drinkable. We've had it even tested. It's really good. and it's quiet, it'll be a good place to meditate too, and to drink tea, and to grow tea. But yeah, and it just came out of the blue, the donation. And so now it's all about just raising the money to build it and getting that abundance, and opening the channel so that it belongs to everyone, so that whatever you give will be clear. We some charities can't keep things clear. That's just a physical limitation. Like, they want to help orphans, and they have to have an office, and they have to then have some secretaries in there who are paid. And, like, that's just understandable. Every charity is like that, and it's not a bad thing. It's just the way things are. What's really awesome is that we have 0.0.0 overhead. Nobody's paid a dime. No fees, no offices, no, you know, all of us are volunteers. So it's a really clear way of life, because it's a spiritual,
yeah,
it's quote-unquote charity. It's not more, you know, it's not really a charity in that sense of being an organization. So
you're modeling nature. Nature doesn't have anyone on salary.
Yes, exactly. And just and making it really clear so that things so that every, you know, penny cannot get lost anywhere, and can go to the good of everybody that comes, and to making this a place that belongs to everyone, so that everyone can use it and everyone's welcome. And we have a plan to start a new tradition. As I said, new insights. Here's one of our new insights. We are going to arrange it so that the coals in the main hearth in the main building never go out. A lot of Native Americans would carry their fire with them as they move, because the fire at the center of the tribe was really important. A big part of what we're doing is also to, for people that want to come and live longer, to have an experience of that kind of tribal communal living, which is really good. One of the best ways to get rid of your own ego is to not react to other egos. And living communally and tribally is in our DNA. We're not happy otherwise. And a lot of our unhappiness in the modern times is about these little boxes that separate us, these concrete boxes, these metal boxes that we drive around in. We eat in restaurants, we sit on right next to each other, but we don't see each other. And that, we need that tribal stuff. They recently did a study of centenarians, people who live to be 100. And the 97% or some really high percent of them, the number one thing they all had in common was incredibly strong social connection and viable meaning in a community and or family. So it's essential to our health. Actually, only 40% had ever in their life had any kind of special diet or exercise. And even less had exercised in the last 30 or 40 years. 6% of them chain smoked for 50 years. And they asked one, like, 107-year-old guy who chain smokes 2 packs of cigarettes a day, what's your secret? And he was still working. He was in Britain. He's still working as a mechanic. And they asked him, what's your secret? And he said, well, during the day I go to work and I'm needed. I'm still teaching the others. I'm needed there to fix cars. And after work, I go down to the pub and I have a pint with my friends who have been my friends for decades. And if I wasn't there, who would they drink with? And he, you know, he had quote unquote unhealthy habits, but at the same time, he was really happy and really connected. And so really healthy. And so really also had longevity.
Beautiful. So our time is about up.
Okay.
So my question for you to exit out on it for this little segment is, are you ready to receive, Buddha?
I'm absolutely ready to receive. Give, you know, I am completely open. We are, I should say, is better than I, because this is already, you know, this is a group, even the permanent residents living in the center. And I'm completely open. The more the merrier. I mean, $1 billion and we'll use it properly, and every dime will be used properly, and $8 billion and whatever, you know. That's, if the number got astronomical, it would just mean T centers, plural.
Yeah.
And LA's next.
Beautiful.
So.
And to touch on that, because I this is a part where people, you talk about the clean channel of receiving and not having people on salary and then still being able to actualize and serve others. If you can just share a little bit about that to help inspire others with the possibility of becoming a clean channel with whatever they're doing,
It is possible. I mean, and the universe helps you. When you have that connection to that place that I talked about, the place where we're inside, where we're all divine, that namaste, where the divinity bows to the divinity in you, and you, whatever you bring out of that stillness, that whatever name you, whatever pointer you use to call that thing, soul, spirit, higher self. I mean, people have many pointers. Whatever word, doesn't matter if you use to point that. But whatever you create out of there will connect not only to the spirit of the universe, but to that same place in other human beings where we are one. And they'll feel it. And they want to live from there too, whether they know it or not. They want to live from there, and they need to live from there because that's our evolution. And when you create from that space, you'll be supported. You may not have what you want, but you'll have what you need to do that work. And it might mean simple. That's okay too. We are creatures of comfort, and unfortunately, we can get into deep comfort rots. And so sometimes, for some situations, it's important for some people on their spiritual journey to discipline themselves and limit comfort. I definitely live very simply. I don't sleep on beds, et cetera, et cetera. I'm a very simple person. And that's important for me so that I don't get stuck in ruts of comfort, you know, so that I can have some discipline. But, you know, as my dear brother taught me just yesterday, what's missing from the world is love and trust. And so what you're talking about is fear. And the antidote to fear is trust. And with trust comes, my dear friend taught me, abundance.
Aho. Well, Buddha, thank you. I appreciate it. Look forward to spending more time with you.
Yes, thank you very much. And blessings to everyone.
Once again, I want to thank Wuda for joining us today, and for any of you listeners that would like to get involved in Living Tea and connect to what's unfolding in Taiwan, please click on the links below. There's opportunities to connect with the Tea Monthly through the Global Tea Hut to help be one of the contributors to building the new Tea Institute and School, and or to take a journey to Taiwan and experience it firsthand. We're going to exit out with The Great Prince of Peace by Nawang Chechog. And I invite all of you to sit back, reflect, and take some deep breaths in and imagine connecting with the magnificent wisdom of the Living Tea. And until next time, this is Shi signing out with a deep bow, a soft gaze, and a namaste.
Jenny, don't tell me.